Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In novelist Colson Whitehead's new novel, the year is 1985, and 15-year-old Benji Cooper is out to the beach house for the summer. He's left his almost all-white prep school in the city for his family's beach house in the African-American Long Island summer enclave, Sag Harbor. It's a universal coming-of-age story of BB gun fight, scooping ice cream, and a first kiss. It's also a particular story of privileged black boys coming of age and wrestling with their identities at the beach. This hour on Point, we're talking with author Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Sag Harbor. You can join the conversation. Does it ever get sweeter or more confusing than teenage summer? What about black teenage summer on privileged turf? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is novelist and writer Colson Whitehead. He's the author of the novel The Intuitionist, a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, and the novel John Henry Days, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He received the Whitting Writers Award and the prestigious Genius Grant, a MacArthur Fellowship. His new book is Sag Harbor. Colson Whitehead, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, howdy, Tom.
Hi. Hey, you know, we'll get to the racial topography here, but I wish you'd just give us the geography of summer in Long Island first. Many listeners may know it like the back of their hand, but I don't. My summer beaches were lakes and corn hedgerows. What's this terrain you set this new book in, and cite your African American community in it, if you would?
Okay, we're talking about the East End of Long Island, the Hamptons, which I assume some people have heard of.
Sure, sounds like celebrities and you know, long BMWs.
There, you know, there are various neighborhoods. The town I'm talking about is Sag Harbor, which was a whaling town. It's mentioned in Moby Dick, and it's off the main drag. It's not on the ocean like the more sort of famous Hamptons, like Bridgehampton, East Hampton. It's on the bay. And in the 30s and 40s, African American professionals from New Jersey, Manhattan, Brooklyn, doctors, lawyers, bankers started going out to Sag Harbor. They sort of found an empty tract of land and made it their own. They would come out on weekends, invite friends, and then the next year, those friends would sort of buy a place. Mm-hmm. And so this community sprung up by word of mouth. And Sag Harbor was off the beaten path and sort of very quiet. So I'm talking about the place before became sort of Hamptonsified and mentioned in page six in the gossip columns, and all the celebrities going out there. And my mom started going out there in the 40s, and I spent every summer there until college. So that's the setup.
So this is not just the terrain of fiction. There's a lot of autobiography here as well. This is your youth.
Well, you know, in my previous novels, I've jumped off from a intellectual proposition that I wanted to explore. What if a corporate namer, someone who names products, had to name a town, and et cetera, with my other books. Mm-hmm. And I felt the challenge of drawing more directly from my personal experience would be fun, interesting, and pretty hard. So I felt it was time. I think there's a sort of a cliche about the autobiographical first novel, so I definitely wanted to avoid that because I was so self-conscious when I started writing fiction. But now I'm older and sort of over these sort of weird issues, so it seemed time to do something new, and that's Sag Harbor.
These are lazy days. These are summer days. Your character, Benji, is 15, so these are, by definition, coming-of-age days, and you've got this wonderful kind of language that everybody uses when they meet and greet one another. The book sort of flows from Memorial Day through Labor Day, and it's all about this, as you write, the question of out. When did you come out? How long will you be out? And everything that signified. Just talk to us about that sense of, you know, what people felt when they were there and what it meant to be out at Sag Harbor.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the variations on out are specific to going out to a place in the summer. But I think if you go, like, as you were saying, go to a lake for a weekend, you know, once every year, or visit your cousin once a year and spend a week, and you see a place change over time, you start these rituals. And so one of the rituals is, when did you get out? How long are you out for? Who else is out? And so when you come across someone else from your tribe on that first day, on that first weekend, you have to sort of go through and get reacquainted again. And part of what you do is sort of establish your bona fides. I'm out for the whole summer. I'm out for a week. So-and-so is not coming out anymore, and so you're better than them. And this sort of jockeying starts immediately at the beginning of the summer.
That's kind of the inside the community talk. And then there's the sort of tribal piece of this, which is this is consciously and self-consciously an African-American summer community on Long Island. How strong was that identity, that self-consciousness in your own experience growing up? And was that very, you know, that's just the way you thought about it all the time? Or was it just summer and you were there?
Well, yeah, when I was a kid, I took it for granted. You know, I always went out there and didn't know how special it was. Once I got to college, it was, you know, you sort of get older and more militant. And it's like, oh, the Hamptons are so bougie. I don't want to go out there. So I didn't realize, I didn't appreciate the history. And I guess when I was trying to figure out how to make it into a novel, I was thinking about how each generation has their own idea of what it is. And so the people who came out, my grandparents' generation who came out in the 30s, this was very new. You know, it was an emergent black middle class, and they were sort of staking their claim on the land. My parents, being in their 20s and 30s during the civil rights movement, have a different idea of what black progress is. And then there's my generation, the post-civil rights generation, which appreciates what's gone on, takes it for granted, doesn't really understand all the history and exactly what's going on when we walk around and in the summer place and we're surrounded by other black people.
I want to get a little sense of how these young men, boys, were thinking about that. Benji's dad always has binoculars, kind of keeps track of what's going on around Nineveh and Nazareth, a couple of the community areas there. You've got a passage here where the boys are watching the beach, kind of, I don't know, kind of keeping racial patrol on the beach, if I'm setting that up right for you, Colson.
No, sure. I mean, until the last 10 or 20 years, it was very segregated, and so Azurest, the beach area, was off the beaten path and separate. So here we go.
Yeah.
I took the binoculars from Bobby. The intruders were actually a middle-aged man and woman, soft and shuffling. They clutched their shoes and dug their toes into the damp sand. Every few steps, one of them pointed at some feature of the landscape. The lighthouse squatting on its nest of rocks, the green mohawk of seaweed on a black stone, the pale carcass of an overturned horseshoe crab, as their companion gaped in wonder. Their gender confusion, apart from some wishful thinking on my friend NP's part as he was trying to start something, came from their shapeless clothes, the way they disappeared into the T-shirt khaki shorts combo that was the official uniform of tourists the world over. We should go down there and tell them to get off our beach, Bobby said. He lived in Nineveh, down the way, hence his interest in keeping the sands undefiled by outsiders. But everyone in the developments, whether they lived on the beach or not, felt that selfish tug of ownership when they saw strangers, i.e. white people, on our little stretch. Most of the strollers came from the public beach, visiting friends for the afternoon and then letting their curiosity draw them toward Azurest. We made noises of outrage, but never did anything. There was an older lady or two of the first generation who were known to fly across the sand and admonish strangers that dogs weren't allowed on the beach if the people in question happened to be chaperoning some yapping enthusiast off-leash. But mostly we grumbled to remind ourselves we had rights to assert, and that was enough. Already the couple was turning back. Visitors never made it that far up the beach in those days. Watching them slow down, stop for a conference, and then turn back made you an audience to a familiar pantomime. Something was off. Everyone was brown. The ladies plopped on striped beach chairs and towels, the kids stirring sand with plastic shovels and chipped clamshells. They were every shade in the desert in the dessert menu of words, beloved by romance novelists to describe African-American skin, chocolate and caramel, butterscotch and mocha. Black eyes glared down from the beach houses, the lookouts on the decks of our armada. Yes, something is off, they thought. Let's head back.
Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Sag Harbor, a scene where white strollers backing off of Black Beach there under the gaze of a whole lot of folks on the beach and two boys with binoculars looking on. It's just pretty clear. There's no sign up, but they realize slowly they've walked into a different racial dimension here, Colson.
Which sort of, you know, happens to me all the time when I find myself in the wrong neighborhood in a, you know, certain cities, and your radar goes off and you sort of know that something is amiss. And do you keep going or do you sort of go back to your familiar avenues?
And you're writing here about a fairly affluent community. There's a lot of talk about music in this book. Ain't No Stoppin' Us Now, a kind of theme song maybe of the parents' generation here, but that sort of up and at 'em affluent blacks with a place on the island, a place on the beach.
Yeah, well, I mean, pop culture is very important to the kids, and so I try to use it to sort of explore larger issues as they interact with early hip-hop or new wave. I'm trying to use that to talk about some larger issues. But Ain't No Stopping It Now, it seems to me, is the black national anthem. No matter how old you are, when it comes on, there's something sort of unstoppable about it. And it's always uplifting, so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Sag Harbor. It's a coming-of-age story of African-American teens in summer houses on Long Island, black boys in beach houses, as he writes, and all that comes with that. Colson, how do you look at what's universal and what's unique in this story? I mean, you catch just wonderfully the sort of rhythm of summer, the rhythm of teen summer, the ice cream scooping and scoping out the girls and BB gun fights with boys and all the rest. Here's a boy who goes to an all-white school. This is kind of his black experience. But how different is it summer-wise from any other teen? Color, you know, subtracted.
Well, I think the point is to tap in, at least for me when I started writing the book, was to tap into the universal summer and the universal horror of adolescence. And so while it's a particular story, it doesn't work unless everyone can relate to it in different points, to Benji's horrible flailings, his trials and tribulations. And so while the first, you know, couple of chapters set up the scene, once Benji takes over, it's my intent that the reader, you know, can see themselves in his incredibly crappy minimum wage job, his latchkey kid experience, his trying to figure out the opposite sex.
Minimum wage scooping ice cream, latchkey because his parents are back in the city during the week working. He's out here with his brother, you know, what, just 10 months apart in age, almost a twin, and they're sort of living that. I mean, it's wonderful in a way. It's Lord of the Flies in another way. And what's the horror of it? How do you describe it?
I think the horror is being a teenager and trying to figure out where yourself ends and the world begins. And how do you leave your private room and enter, like, the stage of community? And so he's trying to figure out what to wear and who to be. And it's confusing during the school year because he likes hip-hop and new wave, and how can you like both? And it's confusing in the summer when people, you know, his black friends are pretending they don't like Tears for Fears, but actually they're really grooving to the video when no one's looking. And so everyone's performing, doing some sort of performance of who they think, of what they think it is to be a teenager, a black teenager, a white teenager, but everyone's faking it. So that's part of a lesson he learns.
There's a reading I think you've got there, Colson, that starts right off with your phrase, black boys with the beach houses, which gets into some of the tension, the conflict about being black in the situation. Parents with a certain standing economically back in the urban world behind. I wonder if you could read some of that for us.
Sure. I mean, are you really black if you have a beach house? So, yeah, it's a bit of a paradox. So here we go. Black boys with beach houses. It could mess with your head sometimes if you were the susceptible sort. And if it messed with your head, got under your brown skin, there were some typical and well-known remedies. You could embrace the beach part, revel in the luxury, the perception of status, wallow without care in what is meant to be born in America with money, or the appearance of money, as the case may be. No apologies. You could embrace the black part, take some idea you had about what real blackness was, and make theater of it, your 24/7 one-man show. Folks of this type could pick Bootstrapping Striver or Proud Pillar, but the most popular brands were Militant or Street, Militant being the opposite of bougie capitulation to the man, and Street being the antidote to upper-middle-class emasculation. Street, ghetto, act hard, act out, act in a way that would come to be called gangsterish, pulling petty crimes, a soft kind of tough, knowing that there was someone to post bail if one of your grubby schemes fell apart. Or you could embrace the contradiction, say, what you call paradox, I call myself. In theory, those inclined to this remedy didn't have many obvious models. In Bobby's case, his birthright, if we could call it that, made him a premature nationalist. The customary schedule for good middle-class boys and girls called for them to get militant and fashionably Afrocentric the first semester of freshman year in college. Underlining key passages in the autobiography of Malcolm X and that passed-around paperback of Black Skin, White Masks. Organize a march or two to protest the lack of tenure for that controversial professor in the Department of Black Studies. Organize a march or two to protest the lack of a Department of Black Studies. It passed the time until business school. Bobby got an early start on all that, returning to SAG from his sophomore year of high school with a new, clipped pronunciation of the word whitey and a fondness for using the phrases white identified and false consciousness while watching The Cosby Show. It caused some problems as he fretted over his zip code. Scarsdale ain't nothing but a high-class shantytown. It's a gilded lean-to. And how changing his name might affect his Ivy League prospects. Your transcript says Bobby Grant, but you said your name was Sadat X. We used to make fun of him for being so light-skinned, and this probably contributed to some of his overcompensating. The joke was that if the KKK came pounding on Bobby's door and demanded, "Where are the black people at?" It's well known, of course, the fondness for the KKK for ending sentences with a preposition. Bobby would say, "They went that away," with a minstrel eye roll and vaudeville arm flourish. He rebelled against his genes, the Caucasian DNA in his veins, square dancing in there with his strong African DNA. It's a tough battle, defending one flank against nature while nurture snuck in from the east with whole battalions. He directed most of his hostile talk at his mother, who worked on Wall Street. "My mom wouldn't give me $20 for the weekend. She's kissing a white man's butt all day, Morgan Stanley cracker, and can't give me $20. In 2 weeks, his parents were going to give him a used sob for his birthday. Generosity that created a whole new genre of bitterness. "My mom's so busy trying to get a pat on the head from NASA, she can't give me gas money, telling me I should get a job." Doing what? Kissing a white man's butt? His mother bore the brunt of his misguided rage, even though his father worked at Goldman Sachs, so it's not like he was a dashiki-clad counselor running a community center somewhere. Get a bunch of teenage virgins together, and you're bound to rub up against some mother issues. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone, cast the first plucked-out orb of Oedipal horror.
Colson Whitehead reading from Sag Harbor. There, where 1 minute on the radio, as he writes, you've got Kieran Carpenter singing, "I'm on the top of the world looking down on creation," and the next minute, the father in this story has on angry black talk radio talking about police brutality in crummy schools, idyllic summer and summer of horrors, all wrapped up in one. Colson Whitehead joins us from New York, and Colson, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let me go to Nashville, if I may, and Aaron. Aaron, you're on the air with Colson Whitehead.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And I was really intrigued by the passages being read. I just wanted to say that. But I want to talk about an experience of mine. I feel like my generation, I'm 26 years old, I've always been told that racism doesn't exist. But when I was younger, I was held against my will in a convenience store, and I was accused of shoplifting. And it was puzzling to me because I figured that I always followed the rules. I never acted out of line, but here I was being accused of being a criminal. And there was that thing in the back of my head that said, I'm being profiled because of my race. But at the same time, I had the conflict of thinking, well, racism doesn't exist. And that still sticks with me today, the constant wondering and fear of being accused when I did nothing wrong.
It's a great angle, Aaron, and let us put it straight to Colson Whitehead. Colson, you know that angle on life, or surely do. Aaron testifies to it right there. At the same time, we've got in the New York Times, Touré writes about you and others being post-black with Barack Obama in the White House, unapologetic about that. Both at the same time? Both in your book?
Well, I mean, I think you can't say that racism is over. I think, what Touré is getting at is this idea that there's no rigid black identity, and it's more open now. I think it's always been open, or else I wouldn't have been able to sort of write the books I've been writing all these years. I think that I could take a wrong turn in certain towns, and I would discover quickly, how post-black I really am. The sheriff would say, don't let the sun, set on you. And I would say, but I'm post-black. Like, didn't you read the New York Times? I was on the cover of the New York Times book review with my face.
Right.
Don't you recognize me? So, no, I mean, I think we're making baby steps. No.
But what is Aaron in Nashville supposed to think about these relatively privileged black kids on the beach on Long Island, kind of held at arm's length from that sheriff? Being held in a convenience store. I mean, if there's post-black, it's not feeling too post-black when they've got the arm on you in the store. You didn't shoplift it, but you're black and it's yours, baby.
Well, you step out of the black neighborhoods in Sag Harbor and you're on white Main Street and, you're an oddity. I have a bit of fun about buying watermelon and walking down Main Street. Can you do it? Like, what if a white person saw you walking with a watermelon? You're going to a potluck and you're assigned to get a watermelon. Can you not get it? Because white people might see you. I mean, you're always on display and you're always sort of an other, particularly once in Sag Harbor, once you step out of your own neighborhoods and enter into the sort of larger White Hamptons. And, being affluent or relatively affluent obviously is no protection from racism and the sort of racial terrors of the world. I mean,
Touré writes, a decade ago they called post-blacks Oreos because we didn't think blackness equaled ghetto, didn't mind having white influencers, didn't seem full of anger about the past. But then he looks at you and Kanye West and Zadie Smith and says, can do blackness their way without fear of being branded pseudo or incognigro.
Yeah, I mean, over the last few decades, people have written about this. Trey Ellis, in his essay about the new black aesthetic, talked of cultural mulattoes, people who borrow from all different sorts of traditions without the anxiety of, oh, that's white, that's black, and am I doing the wrong thing? So I guess I like a larger definition of post-black, which is just doing your own thing. I mean, I think any artist who is, trying to do something new and have a distinctive voice is borrowing from whatever they have at hand. And you can't get hung up on, is this proper to use and is that improper? You have to do whatever serves you, whatever serves your art and also serves your life and your personality.
Let's take a call from Cheryl in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air with Colson Whitehead.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had an interesting experience. I'm in my 60s, and when I was in the 50s, I was a 10 to 12-year-old child, mm-hmm. and we lived in central Massachusetts on a small lake that had a summer camp at one end of it that was exclusively for upper-middle-class black children.
Okay.
And it was kept very isolated from us, and we could hear them yelling and screaming at their swimming lessons
sure.
and having a grand time, and always kind of lived in awe of these special kids that came in the summer, and we were living there all year long, and they got all this wonderful treatment. And then one day, one of their school buses had an accident very near my house, and we all went running out to help. We could hear the people screaming, and we mm-hmm. all went running out to help. Mm. And lots of the children, of course, were bleeding and crying and all of that sort of thing, and we were all helping. And I have to honestly say it was probably the single best equalizing moment in my entire life. To be there, black girls and white girls together, and trying to help one another, and we could see that they cried and laughed and bled just like us. And even though they were kept separate because they had the fancy camp, we were just neighbors. We were locals, and they were the special people. And so I had sort of the reverse experience, but it brought me to a place of being happy that I had them in my life and that I was able to learn from that experience.
Shel, that's a great story, particularly...
It helped me a lot with racism later on.
Yeah, but particularly this story coming from the 1950s. I mean, this is when you had something really unusual going on. Colson, how about the story? And then your choice of setting in time. You're talking mid-1980s. Cheryl's talking 50s. And yet still in the 80s, you've got a lot of these dynamics of separation going on, of looking on at the other, even if from across the ice cream counter.
Oh, sure. I mean, definitely. I think in talking and starting to talk about the book and encountering people who are starting to read it, you know, it's only been out 2 weeks. I keep getting this strange response where people say, "Oh, I'm a 55-year-old white woman from Wisconsin, but I could relate to the people in the book." And I always get surprised because you're supposed to relate the people in the book. And do you only read books by 55-year-old white women from Wisconsin?
Right,
like,
right.
Sort of like, I mean, obviously you have to be able to step out of your own skin, I guess. I'll go with skin.
Yep.
And if the book works, you know, you see yourself in it no matter who the characters are. So, in talking about the passing generations, the kids out there are left on their own during the week. And people say, "Oh, that would never happen now." They call Jerry Springer or something, or the child services, if you left your teenage kids alone Monday through Friday and only came on weekends. And I'm reminded of people talking about the 50s where it was like a halcyon time. You didn't like lock your doors and there was no crime and you walked around happy. And I see the 80s as like that. When growing up as a teenager, I didn't feel particularly safe or, in the world. But looking back, in Sag Harbor, we didn't like lock our doors and everyone looked after each other. And if my parents were away and something happened, we'd go to the neighbor next door and they would drive us. And so my idea of the halcyon 80s is not maybe as pure as the 50s.
But it doesn't have the 50s tang of being completely pre-civil rights era or nearly pre-civil rights era.
Well, it's segregated and there are sort of different rules going on. And so while a lot of their advantages are the fruit of the civil rights movement, they're being their success is being enacted in this very separate stage.
Colson Whitehead is with us. His new book is Sag Harbor. He writes there, we mentioned the Carpenters. He talked about hearing her on the radio as the young man's family heads out for the summer on Long Island. Says, every time Karen Carpenter moved her mouth, it was like the lid of a sugar bowl tinkling open and closed to expose deep dunes of whiteness. One more song like that and his father would punch the button and it would be angry, black, New York City talk radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the leaves on the trees and the touch of the breeze, there's a pleasing sense of happiness for me. There is only one wish on my mind. When this day is through, I hope that I will find that tomorrow will be just the same for you and me. All I need will be mine if you are here. I'm on the top of the world again, down on creation, and the only explanation I can find. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with novelist Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Sag Harbor, a coming-of-age story of African-American teens in summer houses on Long Island. Colson Whitehead joins us from New York. Let's get a call from Kevin in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
Mr. Whitehead. I grew up in Southampton from fifth grade on, and it always seemed like the whitest place in the world. My mother lives in Sag Harbor now, and I'm wondering if part of this novel isn't a poke in the eye to the lily white Sag Harbor folks who like to think that their town is pure.
Colson Whitehead.
Well, it's not a poke in the eye. It's sort of like just my reality. So I think, you know, there's a part early in the book where I'm describing the town, and Benji says, you know, our neighborhood begins in the margin of the travel guide. Literally, the black neighborhood starts where the map ends in most of the Sag Harbor books. So, you know, it is separate, and I thought... I think by calling it Sag Harbor, I wanted to lay claim to it, to this, to Black Sag Harbor, and say that, you know, we exist also. It's good material, so that's why I sort of started using it. But I also wanted to get the story out here because it's not really well known. People know about Oak Bluffs,
on Martha's Vineyard,
on Martha's Vineyard, but there are a lot of these communities because, you know, we're, I don't know, 20 million black people. So, because, you know, so there's a variety of experience in the North and the South. And so this place was not well known, and I wanted to sort of get it out there.
Kevin, thanks for your call. Let's get one more from Hampton, Virginia. Hugh, you're on the air with Colson Whitehead.
Thank you, Tom. I was wondering if Mr. Whitehead had any interaction with... Native people, or if they were still around when he was coming of age there on Long Island, such as the Montaukett or the Shinnecock people, and if there was really any interrelationship or sympathy for Native Americans on Long Island.
Let me ask you as well, do you know Long Island or youth in New York?
Well, I've been out to five towns, and I used to work with telecommunications company out of Long Island, but those were my only contacts really with Long Island.
I see a note here that you grew up in Flushing. Did you know this neck of the woods in the summer, this kind of affluent African Americans at the beach? Was that part of your scene?
No, not at all. I didn't realize actually that there was a summer community, beach community of blacks in Long Island actually. So this is a revelation for me.
You know, I wonder, thank you very much, Hugh. Colson, there's a question about what about Native Americans on the island, but also the sense of this book, this little slice of life, summer life, more or less your summer life, being a revelation to an awful lot of people who weren't lucky enough to be part of that little number who enjoyed it.
No, yeah, sure. I mean, in terms of the Native American population of Long Island, not so much. I mean, when I was a teenager, I didn't, you know, I was not particularly curious about other folks in the neighborhoods. And we were mostly bicycle-based. And then when we, in our later teenage years, got cars, it was mostly trying to go to 7-Eleven to buy beer. Next door to Azurest and Sag Harbor Hills, these black communities, is Eastville. And that was the original black and Native American part of Sag Harbor, where the guys who worked on the ships, black and Native American workers, would live. And so eventually it sort of transformed into the summer community. But it started off as a Native American and black neighborhood in Sag Harbor. And once they stopped slaying the whales and getting all the blubber together, they'd walk down to our neck of the woods, where a lot of the book takes place.
I wanted to pursue that theme of class in the black community. I've got an online message here from MJ, a 42-year-old black woman, and who sort of describes her childhood on the wrong side of the tracks or the other side of the river, he says. Her aunts and uncles on the other side. And said they teased us when we visited about how we dressed, the music we listened to, how we spoke. We went to church in an upper-class black neighborhood where they teased us for not having enough money, not being part of the rich black clique. To this day, she writes, I have a hard time making black friends and relating to black people. There's some lingering resentment of class in black America. How do you look at that class line in that community today, Colson?
Well, you know, I'm trying to explore these different sort of things that sort of, you know, we see each other so separate. And what I'm trying to get in the book is that, you know, we all are having these sort of universal experiences, these longings, these ideas that were inauthentic. He's, you know, am I black enough? The question that sort of Benji has, am I too white? these sort of lingering doubts. What is it to be rich? What is it to be well off? You know, these sorts of these different ways of approaching the self are what I'm trying to, you know, address in the book. And so, yes, you're inauthentic if you're not rich. You're inauthentic if you're not black enough. You're inauthentic if you're not white enough. You're inauthentic if you're not embracing, you know, the sort of bougie lifestyle. And so that sort of interplay of and dance of meaninglessness is what I'm trying to talk about in the book.
I want to bring the theme of your book, Sag Harbor, right up to date, if we may. Over the weekend, we had the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Since Obama's election, you've written about the president. You wrote a very funny essay about not just the first black guy in the White House, but the first skinny black guy in the White House, like yourself. Came up a couple of different, several different ways on Saturday night. Here's one where President Obama takes a jab at African-American Michael Steele, who's the chairman of the Republican, of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, in the audience there. Here's the president.
Michael Steele is in the House tonight. Or as he would say, in the heezy. What's up?
And Michael Steele standing right up with a big smile for that. It wasn't the only color joke from the president, but here's a funny one poking at Republican from Ohio, John Boehner, who's famous for what looks like a kind of a roll-on tan. The president took a little jab at the perpetually tan Republican.
In the next 100 days, our bipartisan outreach will be so successful that even John Boehner will consider becoming a Democrat. After all, we have a lot in common. He is a person of color, although not a color that appears in the natural world.
And then Colson Whitehead, one more, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Here's Wanda Sykes, who was the MC for the evening at the Correspondents' Dinner. She said she was pleased to be able to call Barack Obama the first black president.
This is amazing, you know, the first black president. You know, I know you're biracial, but the first black president. I mean, it's proud. You're proud to be able to say that. You know, the first black president. You know, well, that's unless you screw up. And then it's going to be, what's up with the half white guy, huh?
Wanda Sykes for the president there at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. What about it? Does President Obama, I mean, given the theme that you explore so wonderfully in this book, does he make it easier for people to figure out if they're black enough or too white, or does he make that just a less relevant conundrum for young people, young, you know, black people like you were?
Well, you know, we're talking about constructions that are, you mm-hmm. know, real, illusory, and I think it helps to have a good sense of humor about them, as we just heard. I think, you know, my daughter is 4.5, and we shared this great moment a few months ago where, you know, I don't really wear a tie often, and I did wear a tie because I had a function or something. And she said, "Daddy, you look just like the president." And I was like, wow, like the world has really changed when wearing a tie makes you presidential. Or that's like the first thing that comes to mind.
That's all it takes, right?
So, you know, definitely my idea of what it is to be black in America is different from my grandparents' generation and my parents. And my daughter is going to have some, you know, new kooky idea of what authenticity is when she hits her teenage years, good Lord. And that's, you know, a kind of progress. And I think, you know, it helps. I don't want to get too Pollyannish about, like, now we're in our post-racial future and everybody's just, you know, holding hands and
But the boys in your book really struggle with this, how to be, on the one hand, ambitious and affluent and part of that world and go, they're off to prep school at the same time, how to be, as you say, black enough. Do you think that's becoming less of a struggle, or less of a struggle only for some kind of particular strata of black America?
You know, I think so. I mean, and I hope that it's less important. Although that period where we are sort of constructing the self, you know, is not going to change. And so while the terms might vary from generation to generation, I think it'll always be kind of horrible to be a teenager.
There is that. Regina in Norfolk, Virginia. You're on the air, Regina.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wanted to thank Colson for bringing to light the black middle class culture. I grew up black and middle class in Virginia and southeastern Virginia, and oftentimes it poses quite a dichotomy. One, other folks don't exactly know what that lifestyle is about. It also causes a dichotomy because, again, you know, you're sort of in the crack between black culture and white culture, and it's a discussion I think that really needs to be, you know, brought to the table. And again, I wanted to appreciate, let him know that I appreciate his point of view and thank him for doing that.
Regina, is it getting easier to be in that middle class and be recognized that way? I also wonder if it's getting easier to forget about all those who aren't in that middle class.
I think it has gotten easier, but I don't think it's necessarily easy. For me personally, I just kind of made a commitment that I am what I am, and that's the way, I don't apologize for it, and I don't make excuses for it either. I think that's gotten easier, but that may be a personal thing because of my own, you know, maturity. I'm almost 50 years old, yeah. So.
Regina, thanks very much. Colson, I wonder, I saw Bob Herbert writing the Times over the weekend saying, citing a report that says, if unemployment in this country goes to 10%, which is widely assumed that it may well in the next year, 50%, according to this report, of African-American children will live under the poverty line. Now, that's a long way from middle class and your nice beach in Sag Harbor.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the middle class beach is an image. You know, I think, you know, I have a lot of fun with pop culture in the book, a lot of with music, but also The Cosby Show. Because when The Cosby Show came out in the mid-'80s, we embraced it as a sort of ideal or this depiction of ourselves. Like we were finally on TV and it wasn't Good Times and it wasn't this sort of minstrel show. It was The Cosby Show and we embraced it as this image of affluent black America, which, of course, like all TV doesn't exist. And so... Well, we can have this idea that there is this, class that's well off, and things are getting better, and it's being promoted by the media, by pop culture, by a new sort of face in the White House. No, the reality is that things have always been pretty hard for a lot of people, and they'll continue to be, and we'll continue to struggle. So, you know, my book isn't an advertisement for the end of poverty and the end of class division and the end of racism. It's a way into sort of trying to think about these things in a different sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Michelle in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Michelle.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually very relieved to hear the author say what he just said. I haven't read the book. It sounds wonderful, and I'm going to go get it right now. But I'm a 58-year-old white woman, and I've been quite concerned about this term, the sort of post-black, post-racial society. For me, it just feels like white America's, so, you know, it's another way out. It's like colorblindness. We don't notice, it's not a problem anymore, and it's over. And so I think it worries me. It seems a way to sort of get white America off the hook prematurely, I guess.
But can you relate to some African-Americans who might also at the same time feel a bit liberated by it? I mean, Touré, who wrote this in the Times, is African-American himself, and he's celebrating it.
I can. I did see a wonderful panel with Charlene Hunter Galdon, a few people right after the election, and they were all people my age, African-American people my age, who said they couldn't relate to the term either. So I wonder if age has something to do with it.
Colson, what do you say?
Well, you know, I mean, as I was saying before, I sort of interpret post-blackness as a celebration of the individual. I mean, it's saying that we can do what we want and not be sort of burdened by other people's expectations. You know, we can be this higher self. And so I think there are many different sort of definitions of post-black. The way Touré was describing it, it's this sort of intellectual freedom. And I can relate to it in that sort of way. I can't relate to it as we've entered this sort of utopia and everything's fine and dandy because things aren't fine and dandy.
We're going to go out with a little more music, Colson. You've got, I mean, 1980s, Run DMC is sort of running behind, you know, on the opposite end of the radio spectrum from Karen Carpenter here. Always this balancing act. I mean, and maybe above all for your young, affluent black man, boy, on the beach. And that balance between, you know, how much to be tough and jut that jaw, maybe even be angry, and how much to find one's very individual own way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I picked 85 so I could sort of, you know, talk about these boys turning into men. And the pop culture plays into that. And so the hip-hop they listen to is very corny, like UTFO, Houdini, bands that wear, like, village people-type outfits. You know, they're very campy. Right. Before hip-hop becomes very commercialized and gangsterish in the late 80s and early 90s. And so, you know, hip-hop is in this really sort of innocent time, and so are they. And so there you have it.
There's the other side of the Beach Sound, circa 1985. Colson Whitehead's new book set there is Sag Harbor, and it's really wonderful. I mean, whatever your race brings to mind, that sense of being that age and everything that comes with it. Colson Whitehead, I want to thank you very much for being with us this hour. It's been wonderful to have you. Thank you for the book, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It was a blast.
Off we go with Run DMC. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us. We make up all these rhymes inside our head. The other MCs cannot compete. When we rap on the mic to this big beat, the beat is big. It's kind of large. And when we're on the mic,